When I asked him once whether he was all right, when he was bending over in pain without so much as a facial expression, pretending he was just relieving an annoying muscle strain, the simple answer I received was, it could be worse. Now here we were, both together. His face had mellowed. There was warmth and compassion in his eyes. "You know, John," I said as I looked into his eyes, "all my life I wanted to be your friend, but you never let me. I feel very sorry that we missed out on a good and meaningful friendship." Then John did something that I would never have expected. He took my hand and pressed it affectionately. "I am very sorry, Jurgen," he said. "I didn't even know myself. I was so full of ideas of what life should be like that I didn't develop the ability to learn to enjoy life as I should have." We sat down together on the pavement. John was still uncharacteristically holding my hand and I reciprocated to let him understand from my heart that I felt a strong affection and friendship for him and that it had only been suspended. For the first time I felt its full force and saw in his eyes that he felt sorry and that he really felt a deep appreciation and very brotherly love for me. I noticed a bit further to my right a woman dressed in white who had been eavesdropping on our conversation. She immediately apologized and confessed that she could not help but be part of this conversation, and said how it had moved her. Rarely had she been so deeply touched by a scene of true friendship like this. With that she walked over to her partner, who stood a little further away, also dressed in a white suit, and they both strolled off. It was then that Julia turned up. She was uncharacteristically dressed in a bright blue dress and looked young and vivacious. She started chatting to her brother as if they had never been far apart. I watched the two conversing and wondered what had happened. Julia too, as his own sister, had never been allowed into his private world. But here they were, chatting like old siblings. A moment later she had disappeared. John noticed my astonishment. "I am never far away from my dear sister Julia. I have learned a lot since I have arrived over here. It was absolutely necessary for me to die, because I had to die in more ways than one. Death is not some sort of punishment, but a great learning opportunity. When your life won't allow you to expand your wisdom, then death very often offers new opportunities and may be the only way." During our conversation, John and I decided to carry on with our casual stroll around town. We kept talking intensively and philosophically until I noticed we had begun circling the same block for the second time. He was telling me about his experiences since he had died, how confused he was at first and how little he valued the people now who he had looked up to when still alive and how those people were not as worthy as he had hoped. He also told me that he had taken an interest in classic Greek theater. "Have you been to higher levels?" I wanted to know. "Yes, I have, some much higher than this. I see this as my halfway home. It's pleasant. I quite like it. The higher levels I have only visited, I can't see them as my home yet." I asked him whether he had seen his father, who had died about 10 years ago. He told me that his father had gone on a solitary quest into some totally unfamiliar regions for him. He was on some kind of a quest and that he had embarked on a journey that was of great importance to him for his personal development. I wondered what happened to his father's relationship with his wife, who had just died, and why he was away. He told me that even such long relationships as his parents was no guarantee that they belonged together when coming over here, and that relationships were more based on the intensity of inner bonds. I then remembered the whole reason why I had come over here in the first place, to look in on Julia's mother. I asked John whether he could help me find her. To my great surprise, John was rolling a cigarette and then lit it with his old army lighter. He took a deep puff and blew the smoke into the air with a satisfaction I could feel myself just by looking at him. I laughed out loud. "So you are still smoking, then?" I found this very amusing. Smoking had always been a powerful component in John's life. He had built a whole ritual around his smoking, keeping his roll-up tobacco in a tin with a Buddha picture of mine, which I had given him for his birthday. He would take out a tray, place his brown licorice cigarette papers, tobacco, filters and lighter onto the tray and then start rolling at great leisure his little joints, which he would line up neatly. After he had rolled his daily supply, he would transfer it into a silver 19th century cigarette case, which he then put into his pocket. Then he would go outside, smoke and cough. It was the cigarettes, of course, which killed him, and here he was indulging in his old pastime. "They won't kill me now," he said with a broad grin. "That's the beauty of life here, you can still enjoy your sins." I had started on my second task that I had set myself during meditation, namely to conjure up a bunch of flowers to give to Julia's mother, but I was distracted by John's smoking habit and his rolling of cigarettes. When I looked at my hands where I expected the flowers to materialize, I found to my utter astonishment a bunch of flowers made out of cigarette papers. John laughed out loud and told me that I couldn't focus on two things at the same time. By this time I thought the flower trick was too attention-consuming and abandoned it. Instead I asked John whether it was possible to see his mother. "We could try," he told me. I thought it would be a good idea to try the same method as I'd employed before when I called John. I turned around and shouted very loudly into the market square, "Mum!" But Mum didn't materialize. Instead I noticed heads turning and people trying to find out what my call was all about. I felt embarrassed having drawn this unwanted attention. I decided the next call should be done on a more mental level. This time I received a clear image in my mind of Mum, with a much younger appearance and light brown hair. I instinctively knew that she wouldn't be able to join us. John told me that she was still in an adjustment phase and that it would be some time before she could manage to appear on this level, which was not what she could accomplish at this stage. I took comfort in the fact that I had at least glimpsed an impression of her and that I could tell Julia on my return that she was okay. My second thought was that I could use my out-of-body state to visit her or do some other investigation on my checklist. But I thought I needed to return while this event was still fresh in my mind, in order to record it accurately. 1st of August, 2012. Next headline, non-physical quest for self-healing. It has long been argued and proven that healing can be found using lucid dreams or out-of-body experiences. When we moved house a few years ago, I pulled a muscle in my groin lifting furniture. I was in a lot of pain and found it difficult to move without the pain taking my breath away. On the third day, in the early hours of the morning during meditation, I was able to leave my body and found myself seeing it from the outside, sitting there in my meditation chair, with my head tilted slightly forward, seemingly asleep. On the left side of my groin I saw a 6-inch black hole with dark particles gyrating randomly and chaotically around inside it. I immediately identified it as the trouble spot that had given me so much pain. Not being able to think of anything better to do, I used my out-of-body hands and gently pulled the hole shut, while at the same time sending positive energy into it. Gradually the hole closed and the dark energy dissipated, and soon the dark spot had disappeared completely. I decided to return to my body in order to check whether this was just a hallucination or whether I had actually closed the hole and by doing so eradicated the problem. When I opened my physical eyes, the pain had completely gone. I got up, moved around, twisted my body, there was not a trace of any pain. Not long ago I had been suffering from chronic rhinitis for over 6 months, which ruined my sleep at night. I only managed to sleep for 15 to 20 minutes at a time and was then woken by my dried out mouth, as my nose was completely blocked. This had also prevented me from having out-of-body experiences, except for one. The last few days it had become almost intolerable. I kept sneezing and coughing until I ached and was exhausted. At about 3 o'clock the following morning I finally decided to try meditation, intending to focus solely on the inner lining of my nose. This was an absolute first, as I had never ever meditated on the mucous membrane before. My usual practice was to focus on awareness. I focused on the inside of my nose without fail for an hour and a half. I also made the firm resolve that should I fall asleep or induce an OB, I would use this to restore my physical health as I had done in the past when I strained my muscle. Sure enough, after about a couple of hours I fell asleep, then woke up suddenly. Noticing that I could see my meditation room through closed eyelids, I decided to use the hover test to establish whether I was already detached from my body. It worked. I hovered 2 feet above ground level in my meditation room. Something was strange though. The walls were all yellow instead of magnolia. I turned around to face my physical body in order to attempt the healing. To my astonishment and disappointment, my body wasn't there. This told me I had left the physical plane and was operating on the next dimensional level. Disappointed at not being able to heal my body directly, I made a half-hearted attempt to send some healing energy towards it, not even knowing where it was. Not wanting to waste the opportunity, I decided to call upon my mother, who I hadn't seen for over a year. I called her a couple of times and she soon appeared. I did not recognize her at all. I had become used to the fact that she had a habit of changing her appearance, but this time she had short, light brown hair, wore an elegant, red woolen dress and was aged about 20. I was impressed by how contemporary she looked, and when she gave me a hug I soon realized that there was no mistake, it was my mother. I asked her about her total makeover, to which she replied that I should begin to get over the fact that she was my mother, that there was more to our relationship than mother and son, and that in the past and in the future she was and would be many other things to me, such as a sister, a wife, a close friend or even a husband. She laughed out loud at her last comment and I enjoyed seeing her so cheerful, relaxed and open-minded. Our short conversation told me that she must have been taking lessons in the laws of consciousness and I was duly impressed. I had never been able to discuss any of these subjects with my mother when she was still alive. We then proceeded with a very deep conversation. She told me that she had been aware of my activities since we last met and had been observing how it had positively affected me and my environment, so that she had taken an interest in her own spiritual development. This she clearly demonstrated by her comment that earthly ties are relative and limited, and that relationships are truly multi-dimensional and can happen in almost infinite configurations. However, I was still rather fond of seeing this woman as my mother, because of the powerful memories that went right back into my early childhood. I remembered the poverty and hardships my family endured as refugees after the war. We had very little food and my brother and I suffered from malnutrition. One picture came back clear in my mind of my mother whisking a raw egg and mixing it with a spoon of sugar. My brother was sitting on one knee and I was on the other, and she would feed us alternately a teaspoon of egg each. While she was doing it, she would sing to us in the sweetest voice and rock us gently. I don't remember feeling the hunger, but only her deep love, the happiness and security. This was still the same deeply loving woman in a radiant youthful disguise that displayed her inner love and beauty. She proceeded to discuss family relationships, the fact that she was very fond of my wife Julia and that my father was reincarnated in Eastern Russia. She also told me that relationships develop, even difficult and complicated ones. Finally, we said our goodbyes. It was a very deeply rewarding reunion with my mother, and if there is one thing to be said for out-of-body experiences, it is the fact that it bridges the abyss death leaves between loved ones. Death is the great deception and blemish of our lives, and we would be well served seeing it for what it is, a temporary parting of ways that can be overcome by nurturing our dreams and turning them lucid. After my mother had left, I turned my attention towards locating my physical body for healing purposes. I tried to figure out a way of returning without waking up physically. While meandering around, I was then sidetracked by a party taking place in a large hotel or office-type building. I recognized the astral counterpart of the physical location, which told me that I wasn't far from home and I was going to approach my body via the non-physical dimension until I was back in my meditation room again. But the party was very distracting and I decided to join it. It was a fairly big event with about 50 to 100 people and a huge buffet with the most delicious foods. To my utter delight, I realized that I could smell again. I had lost my sense of smell and taste as a result of the rhinitis for over 3 months now. I was thrilled that I had my sense of smell back and could appreciate food again. The food was good and I soon found myself chatting to other guests. As is my habit during OBEs, I am keen to interview people to learn more about their afterlife experience, their world and condition in order to strengthen my research. Eventually, I decided to return to my body with the intention of remaining detached and perhaps practicing healing. Instead, I woke up, finding myself slumped over in my chair. Despite my failure of healing while out of the body, I noticed a significant improvement. Though unfortunately it was not permanent. Next headline, Nature's Justice. Subheadline, Consequential Entanglement. Science teaches us that every action has an effect. Life teaches us that our actions have consequences, although we may not notice it straight away or even not at all. The reason we have crime is because criminals believe they can get away with it and the outcome will be favorable to them and unfavorable to their victims and that there is no further variable to this equation. Nature works quite differently and on closer inspection throws up variables that present all actions in a completely different light. Put simply, hardly anybody is aware of the complex entanglements our actions create, not just on the physical but on multi-dimensional levels as well. Even inconspicuous actions can create a fallout which can reverberate throughout history. A word spoken unthinkingly can affect the whole life of a person, and I know for sure of one person whose life was steered into a different direction by a simple observation made by another person. Everything we do and say becomes part of a complex web of entanglements we are linked to in a positive as well as in a negative way. From a higher consciousness viewpoint, these systems can look like the neuron system of a brain where messages dart across a network of pathways and centers, triggering new impulses that dart off in different directions. Then they are stored and released again when certain conditions are met until the original system of impulse reaches a state of equilibrium again. Every action, reaction and outcome is recorded on the greater consciousness system like an input sequence on the hard drive of a computer. The cosmic hard drive, though, is infinite and never runs out of space. Every action that has not resulted in equilibrium will forever vibrate and be active until all entangled aspects have been harmonized and laid down as an experience by the greater consciousness system, where they can be called up at any time. To better understand this process is to visualize our physical life like a cylinder with a valve that lets out our action. Once outside, the actions cause an effect and a reaction and run their course of entangled effects. Inside the cylinder, we are shielded from the effect via its thick walls and completely unaware of the effects caused by our action. We simply carry on pumping out our action as if nothing has happened, ignoring or oblivious of the effect. Let's see what happens when the thick cylinder with its impregnable walls is removed. In other words, when our physical life comes to an end. Suddenly all our actions, the effects and reactions are all around us. We no longer have the protective wall to shield us from the effects. Not only will we revisit our action, but we will also feel and experience the full impact they have caused on others, and not only that, but we experience them exactly as the person who was recipient of our action. They could be either a victim or beneficiary. We have to look at these principles not in terms of punishment or reward, but simply as a law of physics or even quantum physics if you like. We can see there is no judging angel, no devil or vindictive or rewarding celestial entity involved. It's just nature in the way consciousness functions on its own sets of laws. As our understanding of the finer physics advances, we may even be able to apply this knowledge and implement it in our education and thereby design completely new types of penal systems, which would be based on counseling, education and coaching. Perhaps with some interactive learning tools of virtual reality and so forth, rather than prisons and punishment. Attached to this would also be rehabilitation processes, which would enable the person to enrich society rather than be a drain on resources. How we can address and balance out our own negative output will be considered at the end of this book. It's only when our actions are aligned, harmonized and synchronized with the natural flow of the greater consciousness that we are no longer entangled with specific actions. In esoteric teachings, this action, which does not create any new karma, is action-aligned to cosmic intent, guided by the wisdom of the heart. Although this action also creates an effect, it is in harmony with the natural flow of the universal consciousness, and often has a far wider-reaching and more potent effect. Actions initiated via the ego or built on an idea, assumption or belief, inevitably lead to entanglement with incalculable and unforeseeable consequences. The following experience is a clear and very graphic demonstration of this process in action and shows how our misconception of reality, our ideals and distorted beliefs, don't safeguard us from the consequences nature applies to our action once the solid shield of our cylinder, our physical body, has been removed. Reality is always more powerful than any belief, no matter how highly we place it on the holiest of pedestals of our belief system. A whole culture feeding on misdirected religious ideology is sealing the fate of many of their often hapless followers. Their colossal errors of judgment with their estrangement from reality can have dramatic consequences. The tragedy is that even innocent people falling victim to erroneous thinking are not spared the consequences. When we consider how cruel nature can be, causing death and destruction via natural disasters such as earthquakes and tsunamis, we are forced to accept that innocence does not shield us from the consequences of the laws of nature. When confronted with the outcome of such an action, I was shocked to the core, and I only wished I had the power to call out to these poor unaware souls, who had fallen victim to the propaganda of their leaders, to consider the tenets of love which surely must be at the heart of every religion. 16th of May, 2009. Next headline, The Paradise of a Suicide Bomber. Ever since the 9/11 atrocities of the World Trade Center bombing, I have been wondering what sort of afterlife the perpetrators of such monstrous crimes would earn for themselves. It is obvious to anyone other than the most extreme fanatics that the sufferings endured by the victims, and their loved ones who are left behind, will cause deep, perhaps lifelong, trauma. It is inconceivable to imagine that some deity representing compassion, love and truth could possibly endorse such barbarity. Nature only works because it is rooted in reality, in universal laws that only work because they are finely tuned and balanced. Nature does not act in accordance to a fantasy, however strongly we wish the fantasy to be real. Before I had the following experience, I already suspected that the feelings unleashed by the hapless victims of mass murder and those of their relatives and friends, as well as the indignation of others, would be inevitably focused on the perpetrators in some form or other, but I was not prepared for what I found. Before this, I had a number of out-of-body experiences, though none of what I experienced was worth reporting. When I woke up early in the morning, I knew if I kept my position without moving or opening my eyes, and waited for the familiar sounds in my head, I would be able to return to the OB state and could perhaps, with new intent, make some worthwhile observations. I wasn't wrong, but what was to come rated as one of the most horrifying events I have ever witnessed during my long history of out-of-body travels and the whole of my life, a nightmare without parallel. The concept of belief, suicide, murder and rewards had been lingering as an unresolved topic for a very long time in the back of my mind. What happens to those who blow themselves up and in the process murder and mutilate scores of other innocent men, women and children, while at the same time believing with passion and conviction that they would be rewarded by God for their ill-conceived self-sacrifice? I wanted to know the afterlife fate of suicide bombers. This is not how it started off. When I was back in my OB state, my first intention was to transfer into a spiritual region, but then the old unanswered question came back into my mind. This thought transported me almost instantly to the edge of a region that looked like a dark, 19th century industrial park with bleak buildings covering a vast area and large smokestacks. But this is not what it really was. I saw dark, billowing smoke rising from the ground into a black, menacing sky. As far as my eyes could see, I was faced with a place of menacing desolation. The ground was almost pitch black, with cracks appearing everywhere and porous rough rocks strewn over the wide area as if spewed out by a volcano and then cooled down into black ice. The sky was covered by billowing clouds formed by the smoke rising from the earth, occasionally lit up by sharp angry flashes of lightning releasing ear-shattering thunder, which made the ground tremble. If I had been asked by a film producer to create a scene to depict the end of the world, I would have come here for inspiration. This was an epic Hollywood version of Dante's Inferno. With the next powerful thunderbolt, I began to regret my decision of having come here, but curiosity made me urge myself further into the region until I finally discovered that the evil billowing smoke came from piles of slowly burning human bodies who were wriggling in agony. In the very first pile I encountered, these twisting, charred and convulsing bodies were stretching their hands and clamoring towards a person who was trapped right in the center of the pile, who himself reached towards the bleak sky, desperately praying for help. The person was surrounded by the very real thought forms of his victims and the representation of their pain. However hard he pleaded, his voice never reached past the heavy curtain of smoke that shielded and surrounded him like an impregnable bastion. I quickly noticed that this impenetrable layer was made of regret and the realization that the fate of his victims and their suffering could never ever be reversed or erased. It was a wall of absolute impossibility built from his victims' pain and unbearable suffering and the overbearing realization that this was a deed that could never be undone. That was not the only unpleasant thing that wafted towards me. There was also a smell which became stronger and more repugnant as I entered this graveyard of human misery. All this seemed to stretch for miles, and I was astonished by the vast number of human debris occupying this field. Occasionally I saw dark, sinister figures darting across, who were not part of these piles, trying in vain to pull their lamenting comrades from the heaps of smoldering body parts. They were as dark as their surroundings they came from, their faces covered. Some were brandishing guns, and when they saw me they glared angrily in my direction. Some yelled and took potshots at me, but their bullets fell limply to the ground after traveling only a couple of feet. Despite the horror surrounding me, I was rooted in a placid stillness, knowing that no harm could come to me. Then I reached an area where I heard calls to prayer, but it was carried by a saddened lamenting note, unrecognizably distorted. I then noticed it came from people who had lost their faith, some cursing their God for not keeping his part of the bargain. Others defiantly and unrepentantly proclaimed their fanatical belief by yelling it at an unseen enemy who was barring their way into paradise. Above all, a black impenetrable sky responded with red flashes of lightning and roaring thunder. Then out of the gloom I saw a man approaching me. He did not look out of place in the sinister region. He wore what had once been a white gown but was now dirtied by the ashes. I could see in his face that he was a kind man and devoted to his faith. As he approached me, his hands reached out. He told me how glad he was that somebody else had finally come to help in answer to his prayer, and he praised God for showing such mercy. He explained to me that he was a helper and faced the awesome task to sort out this mess and rescue some of these poor misguided young people. He lamented that there were very few people brave enough to enter here and assist him in his insurmountable task. He directed my attention towards another pile of human remains. I could see severed arms and legs, heads with their jaws missing, and blood and burnt cadavers everywhere. The acrid stench of burned human flesh was everywhere. Right in the middle of the pile was a man wriggling, trying to free himself from the mess, but however hard he tried, he sank back into the pile without the possibility of escape. Every so often he would sound out calling for his God and pleading for mercy, but his prayer had no power. Instead, every time he uttered the name of his Lord, he was confronted with the truth of his deed and how it was in opposition to what his religion had decreed. and now as soon as his prayer left his lips it was reeled back in almost instantly by the agony of his suffering victims which screamed back at him, and every time it did so he felt their pain and the consequences of his act. The image of a mother holding her mutilated child rising out of the pile and then sinking back again, a child clinging onto the dead body of its parents, the horror that consumed their whole being, a horse lying dying in the street, a young man staring in disbelief at his mangled body,